This is our third and last case today. We will have two more cases on Monday. This is 99-1768-CR and 99-1769-CR. State v. Hoffett and State v. Denson. Now, I have what looks to me like a new order. Let me just check it against your understanding. Mr. Stengel, representing Mr. Moffitt, will speak for 15 minutes. Mr. Summers, representing Mr. Denson, will speak for 10 minutes. Assistant Attorney General David Becker will have the floor for 30 minutes. And Mr. Summers has 5 minutes in his model. Okay, fine. We'll begin with Mr. Stengel.
Thank you, Madam Justice. Good afternoon. My name is Attorney Pat Stengel. I represent Melvin Moffitt, opposing counsel, members of the court, members of the audience. The real issue in front of the court today is the propriety of two charges brought against Mr. Moffitt and Mr. Denson in Dane County Circuit Court. They were charged with attempted first-degree intentional homicide as a party to the crime under a conspiracy theory and a conspiracy under Section 939.31 of committing first-degree intentional homicide. The question before the court is a novel one, that is the propriety of these two charges in light of Section 939.72, parent 2 of the statutes, which prohibits conviction under conspiracy under Section 931 and under Section 939.05 of the object of the conspiracy. The two charges are legally distinct in as much as the first charge is premised upon a theory of accomplice liability for a co-ate or completed offense. The second charge is predicated upon the theory of inchoate liability, that is an anticipatory conspiracy. The real issue comes in with this court's decision in State v. Nutley, which created or set forth a legal distinction between a conspiracy as a substantive inchoate offense and conspiracy as a theory of prosecution as a principle for the substantive consummated crime. In Nutley, this court referred to the attempted murder charge as a substantive offense. The description of that offense refers to it as a completed offense. The Circuit Court for Dane County ordered the prosecution to elect one of the two charges because it believed that under Nutley the charge was prohibited and that it raised issues of double jeopardy. Now the Court of Appeals in its decision reversed the trial court and essentially concluded three things. One, that the elements of both offenses were different and therefore the first prong of the Blockberger double jeopardy test was met because it required proofs of different facts, therefore they were not factually the same. The Court of Appeals then addressed the Nutley decision and stated that there was nothing unclear or tentative about the way that the legislature classified the attempt charge. That is, that because the attempt charge is classified under the inchoate portion of the statute, it was clear that this was an inchoate offense. However, if the court looks to section 900.001 paren 6 of the statutes, it indicates that classifications of statutes or subtitles, headings, or sections are not part of the statutes. The Court of Appeals further went on to say that this use of the word substantive, which under Nutley clearly included the attempted murder as the substantive consummated offense, the Court of Appeals described that as incidental. That is, that there was nothing in Nutley really to determine what exactly it meant by the use of that term. However, if one looks at the legal dictionary definition of substantive, it states that what that means is that it is complete of itself and not dependent on something else. So there is really a conflict between the theory of prosecuting someone as a conspiracy theory under the party of the crime statute, which imposes liability for a completed offense, in this case attempted murder, and whether section 939.72 paren 2 of the statutes prohibits charging and conviction based on a conviction under a conspiracy under section
939.31. Counsel, I need some help on the interplay between your Nutley argument and 939.72. Even if you are right that in Nutley it is a, what's the language, a consummated offense, therefore it is coate, is that correct?
Right.
And how does that tie into your 939.72 argument? You still have conspiracy to commit murder and attempted murder as the predicate offense, don't you?
Yes. The way that it ties in is this, is that the coate offense, that is under 939.052C, is in this case, and as in Nutley, the attempted murder. And how that relates to the interplay as relates to Blockberger is that, for purposes of at least the Supreme Court's decision in Nutley, that became one offense. If you look at the Court of Appeals analysis, it broke down the elements of attempt, of conspiracy, and of party to the crime analysis and determined they were different. But if you look at the language of Nutley, it's essentially saying that is one offense. I don't know if that helps answer your question, but there are a number of permutations involved here.
Now, this is at what stage of the proceeding, counsel?
The case is not, this is a pretrial proceeding. The case has not proceeded to trial.
It's on information.
Correct.
Well, what's the matter with going to trial and then only giving him one punishment?
Is it giving the prosecution one punch?
Well, you don't usually punish the prosecution, but in effect giving, if the jury comes back with a verdict of guilty on count one and guilty on count two, he only gets punished for one.
That's correct.
What's the matter with that?
Well, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think that's what the statute is meant to do. But I think that what the argument is and what the statute contemplates, at least the legislative history, is that that charge shouldn't be brought in the first instance.
That's what I'm saying. So you're objecting to the charge. You want the prosecution to make a choice now.
Correct.
On precisely what grounds? Just one sentence.
Well, that the legislative history supports that the legislative history under section 939.722 under the Blockberger analysis indicates that this is double jeopardy, and that section has been interpreted, at least by the Court of Appeals and Kanarowski and Judge Nettesheim's concurring opinion, to prohibit multiple charges.
Mr. Stengel,
yes.
Let's for a minute look at 939.72 paren 2, which you just mentioned. The language is section 939.31 for conspiracy and section 939.05 as party to the crime, which is the objective of the conspiracy. And it says a person shall not be convicted under both. Now, what is your claim was the crime which was the objective of the conspiracy?
My argument has been, and is set forth in our brief, is that the objective of the conspiracy was intentional first-degree homicide.
Not attempt.
Correct.
All right. But the charge here, as I understand it, is attempted first-degree intentional homicide. It's not first-degree intentional homicide. Isn't that what makes your argument in regard to 939.72 paren 2 incorrect?
You're correct, Your Honor, as far as that being the charge in count one. But the reason I think that that is legally distinct is because of this court's definition of what includes the substantive consummated offense in Nutley. In Nutley, it was attempted murder. In this case, it is attempted murder.
In Nutley, this court used the term substantive offense.
Correct.
What the court didn't get into, as I remember Nutley, saying that substantive offense equals a co-ed crime or a completed crime, if you will. That isn't in Nutley, is it?
Not specifically. And I guess I would look to the law review article by Gary Ostis Irwin involving party of the crime liability in Wisconsin. That's something that the trial court relied on, but you are correct that that specific language was not used in Nutley.
I don't know why you come under 939.72 at all. It talks about convictions.
Well, because the argument is that because conviction in the first instance is prohibited, that charging should be prohibited. And if you look at the legislative history of Assembly Bill 100 in the Criminal Code revision in 1951 and 1953.
Yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I did want to welcome Judge Nowakowski from the Circuit Court of Dane County, who has guests with him, a Cuban delegation. So I'm glad you were able to sit in and part of this, and thank you for coming. Counsel, I apologize to you.
No problem. Thank you. The argument is essentially this. The statute prohibits conviction. On its face, that's clear. If you look at the legislative history of that statute, it indicates a desire to deal specifically with protecting the accused and the rule against double jeopardy. Our argument has been from the start, when I first brought the motion in the trial court, that because the conviction is precluded, that likewise the charging is precluded.
Well, can't you charge somebody with a crime and then an included crime in the same, but you can't convict them of both?
That's true.
So how does that fit with your argument?
Well, again, it takes us back to the distinction in Nutley, and the distinction between criminal liability under the party of the crime statute and criminal liability for an inchoate offense under the conspiracy theory.
I want to just stick briefly with the language, as the chief is, of 939.72, no conviction about both. We see all the time in OWI cases, they're charged with a BAC, blood alcohol content in excess of the legal limit, and also charged with operating while intoxicated. But the law provides they only can be convicted of one, although charged with both. I mean, how do you respond to the argument that if 939.72 wanted to prevent a charging of both, the legislature would have so stated? Instead, it just says you can't be convicted. And I put parenthetically, much like the OWI cases with the BAC. How do you respond to that?
Well, that's precisely the argument the state made on its motion for reconsideration, which the trial court concluded was improper. I certainly understand that argument. It's clear that the legislature hasn't stated specifically that multiple charging is prohibited under this theory. They have in the OWI statute. Again, I think if you look at the legislative history, however, of 939.72, I think you come to a different result.
Do you wish to speak further? Are there any questions? Right, counsel?
I will turn it over to Mr. Summers.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Summers?
Okay. Thanks for allowing me to appear before this honorable court. I will jump into the issue that was put before Attorney Stengel. There's a couple of real good reasons not to allow the state to charge both of these offenses and allow the jury to hear both of these offenses, even if the defendant can only be convicted and sentenced on one. And that is, first of all, unlike in the drunk driving statutes, this statute does not explicitly allow that. In the drunk driving statutes, the state legislature took the step to say that you can do this in these cases. It did not do so in regards to this these statutes. Two, I think there's an excellent reason not to do it, and which is shown by the fact why the state would want to do it. Why would the state want to charge both if they could only get a conviction and sentence on one? The reason is because they understand that juries are unpredictable things. There's nobody that believes more in the power and what the jury is all about than myself. But even I understand that juries at times do things that are crazy. They do things that are not rational. You give them two counts like that, you are inviting the jury to split. There's always a chance that the jury could be out for a period of time. There's always a chance of a compromised verdict. And that's exactly why the state would want him to be charged with both counts, is that that gives them sort of that way out. There's always that possibility.
There are different elements of these two crimes, aren't there? Different matters that have to be proved. Right.
Yeah, except though really there you're actually talking about a distinction without meaning, especially in, let's say, in regards to the facts of my client. The same actions that he took that they would be showing to prove that he was in a conspiracy would also be the same actions that they would prove that he was party to the crime of attempted first-degree homicide. It would be identical conduct. So with my client, that would be a distinction with no meaning at all. And if you took that logic, then that means why in all double jeopardy cases just say that it only applies after he has been convicted and when he is sentenced?
And don't a lot of them do that?
Well, actually, no. I put forth that a lot of them do not do that. In fact, it's very atypical, as I said, and in this state, we only allow it in cases where the state legislature has said you can do it in this case, as they've done in the drunk driving statutes.
Mr. Summers, I may misunderstand the position of the state, but am I correct? The state isn't conceding that they can charge on both but can convict only on one. That isn't their argument, is it?
Well, that's the argument that was put forth. I mean, I think it's the argument that was asked by the by the judge.
Well, I understand that the Chief Justice has been asking you questions along those lines, but I just wanted to clarify, you're not suggesting that the state at the trial court level or here has conceded that.
No, in fact, I would say, actually, I think that their argument, which I have attacked in my brief, is they're saying that a defendant who has been charged with attempted, with a crime that has only been attempted should face more potential punishment than a defendant who has successfully completed his crime. That's what they're arguing, which I think is crazy and that's absurd. So that's what they have been arguing. I don't believe that that they are conceding that he can only be convicted and sentenced on one.
Well, am I correct that the Court of Appeals addressed that so-called anomaly and said that if that really does exist, that that's a problem that should be addressed by the legislature?
And there's two problems with that. One is the Court of Appeals' logic really was circular logic. They said the reason why he can be punished for greater is because defendants, let's say in our case, would have been convicted of two crimes versus the other defendant only being convicted of one crime. But the reason for that is because of something that they have created. Because they are the ones that are saying that a defendant who has only attempted the crime that was not completed can be convicted of two crimes, and a defendant who has completed his crime can only be convicted of one crime. So their logic, first of all, it's a circular logic. Second of all, it is an anomaly that I would say violates the plain meaning of the statute. And it is absurd. And there's any way around it. They would be rewarding and giving an incentive to the most ruthless, to the criminal who is more ruthless. And this court, I'm sure, has the imagination that they can understand that in many cases, the reason why a crime is not completed is because the criminal in that crime pulls off. Something appeals to him and he pulls off halfway through. I have defended on a number of crimes like that. Under what the state is proposing, that criminal would have an incentive to go forward with the crime. Be it armed robbery, be it sexual assault, he would have an incentive to go forward because he'd be facing less potential punishment. Two, with that, the plain meaning, the state legislature has said that conspiracy to commit a crime, one can call it A. They have said to be party to that crime is B. And they have said that an attempt for that crime is C. They say you cannot convict on A and B, you cannot convict on B and C. Logic, it's the plain meaning and it's logic then to say you cannot convict on A and C. It's that simple. That is the argument that I put forth. And it is that simple. That is in the plain meaning of the statute. And they are telling you, don't apply any logic at all. Take a little reading that throws out all of logic and do so even though it's going to create a situation in which there will be a reward and an incentive for the most ruthless criminals to go forward and to complete their crimes. I say, and for this court to go along with that, in all candor, I put forth is just simply insane. I guess at this time, I would request that any additional time I have, I'd be able to use in rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Becker.
May it please the court. My name is David Becker. I'm an Assistant Attorney General, and I appear here this afternoon on behalf of the plaintiff, appellant, respondent before this court in both of these two cases, that being the state of Wisconsin. I think as this court approaches this case, it's absolutely critical that you keep your eye on the ball and sort out the various issues that this case presents. I had the distinct impression that in responding to the questions of the court, opposing counsel were muddying the waters with respect to the issues that are presented here and attempting to answer one question by raising a what I would think would be a separate and distinct argument, or what I think ought to be conceptualized as a separate and distinct argument. First of all, remember that the state has two separate and distinct arguments that it is making here with respect to the effect of 939.72.2, and those two distinct arguments are reflected in the questions that the court put to opposing counsel, and that is this. We take the position, at least our first line of defense, is that statute does not apply to this case at all. But if it does, that does not answer the question posed by this case, which is whether or not this trial court properly required the state to elect between the two charges that it leveled. This statute that my opponents are relying on, 939.72.2, only applies to convictions. It does not apply to charging. Now, they suggest to you that when the legislature intends to affirmatively permit charging, even though conviction is ultimately going to be barred, as in the case of the drunk driving, which is probably the classic example of that, they specifically do so. I think they implicitly say the legislature hasn't done that with respect to the two offenses for which conviction is barred under 939.72.2. I suggest to you the legislature has. It hasn't created a specific provision addressing that question, or those two crimes rather, but it has, a few sections earlier in the statute book, 939.65, has expressly provided, if an act forms the basis for a crime punishable under more than one statutory provision, prosecution may proceed under any or all such provisions. Now, I don't know how one could find a clearer expression of legislative intent with respect to the propriety of these two charges, putting aside for a moment whether or not we can ultimately convict. This the second major issue you have to confront.
So you can charge a greater offense and a lesser included.
I think you should be able to, but I, as I said in my brief, Wisconsin case law appears to have carved out an exception to that general rule, precisely the situation that you have described. We generally, there is at least case law, I'm not sure if this court has explicitly stated, but I cited a Court of Appeals decision, whose name escapes me right now, that indicates that you cannot charge both a greater and a lesser. But there, as I explained in my brief, there's a reason for that. That makes some sense, because when you charge the greater, you in effect charge the lesser. Wisconsin law says that if you charge with a greater offense, the jury may be instructed upon, and the defendant may often be convicted of the lesser offense. So it makes sense to say in that context that we're not going to allow you to charge both the greater and the lesser, because you have in fact charged the lesser twice. You charged the lesser when you charged the greater, because the lesser is included within and is part of that charge under Wisconsin law, and then you separately charged it as a lesser. And in fact, it really makes no difference because of the rule that we can submit the lesser to the jury. But that's the problem here, is if we are forced to elect one of the two, we can't submit the other to the jury, and that the state ought to have the option to go to the jury with its full case, lay all the crimes before the jury that it thinks the defendant committed, and then let the jury decide whether he committed one or both.
Convictions to the death.
That then
punishment.
Right, and that takes us to the second issue. I think this first issue is exceedingly simple, based on 939.65. We can charge both of these. The troubling issue in this case, or the more troublesome issue in this case, is whether or not, having charged them both, presented both to the jury, and having guilty verdicts returned on both, we can then go and have judgments of conviction entered on both, and
consecutive
and impose consecutive sentences on both. And that then is when that is where we now turn to 939.72.2, okay, which talks in terms of conviction.
Let me just ask you, other than the lesser included, give me another example, and other than drunk driving, where you can charge two and only get a conviction on one.
Well, I would say primarily the other two subsections of 939-72. Sub 1 prohibits the conviction of both solicitation and a party to the crime which is the objective of the solicitation, and sub 3 prevents conviction of both an attempt and the section defining the completed crime. So there would be two other examples, although albeit that they are within the same statute. Now, I don't know off the top of my head whether or not buried elsewhere in the statute book there is a another provision of that sort.
I thought in the homicide statutes that even though they are not technically lesser included, you can't convict on more than one. Maybe it was a battery statute.
Well,
but that's okay. Go ahead.
I guess you're right. 939-66, the lesser included offense statute, that's right. That's another section with multiple subsections. There must be 10 of them there that talk in terms of upon prosecution for a crime, the actor may be convicted of either the crime charged or included crime, but not both, and then describes a whole bunch of included crimes, the first one being the classic black burger included crime, where the offense didn't require any additional element, but then there are all kinds of other specific ones, including, as you said, the homicide statutes. Battery statutes are all lesser included. The serious forms of battery are all lesser included.
All right.
So
can you charge both under 939.66 if it comes up?
Well, that takes me right back to what I said earlier. We have apparently, I think you ought to be able to myself. And if we're writing on a clean slate, I would say that, and maybe this court is writing on a clean slate, because the only decision I'm aware of that has expressly and specifically said that is a Court of Appeals decision, which I cited in my brief. If I can find it quickly, I will pinpoint that for you. State versus Kennedy, I cited in the Moffitt brief at page 15, at the top of the page, State versus Kennedy, where I talk about that notwithstanding 939-65, there is one circumstance when charging multiple offenses under separate statutory provisions is not permitted. That's when one of the offenses is a lesser included offense of the other. The Court of Appeals has at least expressly said, in that situation, you're not to charge both. I've already explained why I think that does make some sense. If I was writing on a clean slate, I might say to you, why not? What's wrong with that? Because the statute here only prohibits conviction. But I also explained the difference between the two situations, and I'm sorry, I should let you ask your question, Justice.
Well, we got to where 930, your first argument is 939.72 says conviction, so it doesn't apply, so you don't have to elect the charges, okay?
Right.
Now, what's your second argument?
Okay. The second argument is that it doesn't apply because, and I'm specifically focusing on 939.72-2, which is the one that was relied on by the trial court and was relied on by opposing counsel here. It doesn't apply because it does not cover the two crimes at issue in this case.
Okay, we have.
You can go to Nutley and you can argue about labels and you can argue about consummated and you can argue about substantive and all the rest of it. The fact is, let's just return to the plain words of the statute.
Okay.
And the plain words of the statute are these. A person shall not be convicted under both Section 939.31 for conspiracy, and that was one of the two charges in this case.
Right.
And Section 939.05 as a party to a crime, and this is the critical language, which is the objective of the conspiracy.
Okay, what was the conspiracy?
The conspiracy was to commit first-degree murder. First-degree intentional homicide, as we now know.
And he was charged with a party to attempted murder. Isn't that it?
Exactly, and that's exactly why this statute doesn't apply, because he was not charged as a party to the crime, which is the objective of the conspiracy. They didn't set out to commit an attempted murder. They set out to commit a completed murder.
And that's the state's case in a nutshell.
That's the state's case in a nutshell with respect to the applicability of that section. Now, I do understand my opponents to be making an additional argument. And that, although, as I said, sometimes it gets muddled with this argument, go ahead.
Let's finish that. So your argument then is under 939.72 that not only can you charge the conspiracy and the attempt, party to an attempt, but you can get a conviction on both.
Yes. And
and punished cumulatively for both.
Okay. Now you may proceed.
Proceed, okay.
Before you proceed.
Okay.
Before you proceed, I understand the arguments. I understand looking at Nutley. I understand looking at 939.72. I understand looking at Blackburger test and addressing issues of multiplicity. But I'll tell you what I don't understand. That is, it just seems to offend some double jeopardy someplace. I mean, it really seems to me, it's like if you follow everything, I understand the arguments, but it's contrary. But then, the guy's getting punished twice for doing the same thing. Now, he might be charged with conspiracy to do it. He might be charged with part of the crime to do it. But it's really the same thing. And he's getting charged twice. And boy, last I looked, convicted of both. Last I looked, that's a little bit what double jeopardy has to do with. So, it just seems to, it seems to be full of form but lacking substance. It seems to be dotting all the I's but missing the heart of double jeopardy. So, how do you...
Well, I don't think it's... first of all, you're absolutely correct that the most you can say with respect to double jeopardy is that you somehow have some feeling that there may be a violation, but once you attempt to apply double jeopardy principles, you cannot find a double jeopardy violation here.
Well, that's
and you can't.
Maybe Blackburger doesn't adequately address all the concerns of double jeopardy. Maybe that's...
Well, but then you're going to have to go and talk to the United States Supreme Court, I think.
We can talk to ourselves.
Well, that's true. Under the state constitution, we so often forget about that, as Justice Abramson
Hello?
Want to remind us. But the fact is, this court has committed to the Blackburger test. If you're thinking about re-examining that, I would suggest rebriefing this whole case on that question and coming back and arguing another day, because that is so well established in both federal and Wisconsin law that I'm not prepared at this point to go back to square one and talk about it. But I think the Blackburger test answers your feeling, this amorphous feeling that you have that maybe there's something wrong here as a matter of double jeopardy. Because Blackburger does say that you have to have two crimes, each of which have an additional element that the other does not. And so while you characterize this case as one in which the defendant is going to be convicted for doing the same thing, the fact is that's not the case. He's going to be convicted of a conspiracy because...
I know that. I mean, even on a superficial look, you're right. I mean, look, one is charged with conspiracy. That's a different element than party to the crime of attempt. I mean, even superficially, you're right on that. I'm just saying you're right. But in substance, it just seems there's a problem. I mean, I'm not saying you don't need the Blackburger test. You certainly do.
Yeah, but I think the Blackburger test is ought to answer your concerns about substance, because it requires that the state show two separate and distinct things with regard to each of these two defendants. So that Mr. Moffitt, for instance, enters into a conspiracy with the victim's wife to kill the victim so they can share the life insurance policy, and he starts taking acts toward the completion of that objective, obtains a murder weapon, what have you. Now he's committed a conspiracy, but could be convicted at that point of a conspiracy to commit first-degree intentional homicide, and that would be it. He didn't stop there, however. They went well beyond that. They recruited the shooter. They put the gun in the hands of the shooter. Mr. Denson helped drive the shooter to a pickup point for the victim's wife to transport the shooter to the victim's home, where he then pulls the trigger numerous times only because the gun jammed. We have a living victim instead of a dead victim in this case. So I don't understand any concerns about either form or substance when you have...
Time you have more than one defendant and they don't complete the crime. I mean, you've got the double charges with the conspiracy and the party to the crime,
of attempt and...
But not...
But that's every time you do it.
No, but not unless you then go and attempt to commit the crime. This conspiracy could have ended at the point of simply a guilt of conspiracy, but it didn't end there. It went on to take further steps well beyond that any act that's required for a conspiracy. We took steps that fulfilled the requirement of an attempt, which was an act that unequivocally demonstrates under all the circumstances that the person would have been killed but for the intervention of some other person.
If this conspiracy, now this is just an aside, but if this conspiracy involved a week of planning, are you going to charge every day a different conspiracy?
No.
Why now?
I don't think so. I did.
No, that's a rhetorical question.
Yeah.
Could I ask you a rhetorical
question? Well, I mean, to me, it's...
Could I ask a clarification?
Sure.
On the party to the crime, is that under 2A, B, or C, or is it not clear?
Are you referring now to the party to the crime statute?
Yeah.
I am glad you asked that question because my opponent here said something which I want to take issue with, and I have all kinds of things I want to take issue with, but I'm sure I'm not going to be able to get through this list if I get to even take any of them. And that is that he said that the attempt was under a conspiracy theory. I'm not sure of that. All he's charged now is as a party to the crime. There's certainly a basis for the attempt going forward on the theory of aiding and abetting, because both of these men clearly aided and abetted the attempted murder as well as conspired to commit it. And I guess that brings us to what I picked up and relegated to a footnote in my brief, but that even if I am wrong on the Blockberger analysis, when you consider the party of the crime theory being part of the attempt, which you can't do, which is I'm making this argument with the backup of my brief. This is not going to make sense unless you've read my brief. But I indicate that even if we consider the part of the crime theory for purposes of lesser included offense analysis and Blockberger analysis, which, as I say in my brief, my main argument in my brief is you don't do that. But the bottom line is the worst case scenario from the state standpoint here would be that to avoid a double jeopardy problem, you would simply confine the state to an aid and a better theory of liability on the attempt so as not to create a situation where at least the argument is made that one crime is lesser included defense of the other because both are proceeding on a conspiracy theory. A conspiracy is obviously...
What if 939.05 didn't have a B? It only had an A or a C?
Then we could not be proceeding on A because we all agree that neither of these two gentlemen that are the defendants in the cases before the court directly committed the offense. That was a third person. So we would have to be proceeding under C, and then the question would be as to whether or not I hope I understand what you're trying to get at here, which is I think my opponent's argument, and that is that if we are proceeding under a party to a conspiracy theory for the attempt charge, that somehow we have made the attempt the conspiracy charge a lesser included offense of the attempt charge. And then I would respond to that as I have in my brief.
Did they really conspire to attempt?
Because that theory of liability is that under the co-conspirator theory of liability, such a, and I'm reading from 939.05.2c, this provision that you've been referring to, Justice, such a party is also concerned in the commission of any other crime which is committed in pursuance of the intended crime in which under the circumstances a natural and probable consequence of the intended crime. So our theory would be that they conspired to commit first degree intentional homicide and committed an attempted murder as a natural and probable consequence of the attempt to carry out the conspiracy.
What about 939.66, which you referred to? Why isn't attempted homicide or the conspiracy to commit homicide under 939.66.2?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
What I'm getting at, it seems to me under sub 2.
Of 93966?
Yes. It says, upon prosecution, they may be convicted of either the crime or the included crime. And then it defines included crime, but it doesn't define it with Blackburger. It has broad definitions.
Right. Well, the first subsection is Blackburger, but from there on, you're right.
So, two. Why aren't we dealing here with two types of criminal homicide?
Because no homicide was ever committed. It's as simple as that.
So, if you attempt, that doesn't fall under the homicide?
Does not fall under sub 2.
Serious type.
Of criminal homicide, no. No. That's my answer.
Final answer?
That's my final answer. I think I just won $64,000.
Mr. Becker, how do you...
I think of something else, Mr. Becker.
Mr. Becker, how do you get around the language in Nutley that talks about the fact that attempted first-degree murder is a substantive crime?
Well, the simple answer to the word substantive... If I recall correctly, is that with respect to the word substantive, and let me see if I can find Nutley real quickly here. Yes, at the top of page 561 of the decision, and I'm 24 was second here, the Wisconsin Reports version. At the top of page 561, they talk about deciding the wars and distinctions between conspiracy as a substantive inchoate crime, and conspiracy is a theory of prosecution as a principle for a substantive consummated crime. So obviously the word substantive, this court obviously views substantive as an appropriate adjective to apply to both inchoate crimes and completed crimes. So I don't think labeling it as if anything, Nutley stands for the proposition that inchoate crimes are properly referred to as substantive crimes. So if you're going to hang your argument on the fact that conspiracy is a substantive crime, I say fine. Nutley says that there can be substantive inchoate crimes. That does not make it an inchoate, that does not, or I guess maybe the argument is that the attempt is the, I'm sorry, I think I've confused the two crimes, but I think they're arguing that the attempt is the substantive crime. But if you're saying attempt is a substantive crime, and if that somehow doesn't means it can't be an inchoate crime, I say Nutley is the case that defeats you because it talks about a substantive inchoate crime. So that gets them nowhere.
So in other words, as I understand it, you're saying substantive doesn't translate into cohate or inchoate.
I am saying that exactly because they refer to a substantive inchoate crime and a substantive consummated crime. They obviously feel the adjective is appropriate with respect to both, and therefore substantive does not, as you said, translate into one or the other, and in particular does not translate into cohate or completed crime. I believe that we have basically, through the questioning here, gotten out my arguments. I have started out by indicating that we ought to be able to charge both, whatever may be the case with respect to a prohibition on conviction. I then proceeded to argue that there is no prohibition on conviction of both of these. And I, first of all, argued that there is none under the only section that could possibly create that prohibition, which is 931.72.2, because this does not fit within the words of those of that statute. And then, although I didn't present it as a set piece argument, I think in response to questioning here, I was also able to get out at least parts of my argument that insofar as the defendants are raising an independent claim that apart from 939.72.2, there's a prohibition here because we have a multiplicity or a double jeopardy problem, I think the simple answer to that is that each offense requires proof of a fact for conviction that the other does not, and therefore we have no double jeopardy problem.
Okay, now we'll double back. You've taken a position one, you can have both charged, and you can have both convictions and both penalties. That's the state's position.
Absolutely. Now, I see my green light is still on, which means I've got at least 5 minutes left. And I think I ought to at least talk to the court about what I think is the best arguments, the best argument my opponents have, and what my response is to it. And it was alluded to in the questioning here when opposing counsel were up here, and that is, and the Court of Appeals addressed it also, and that is, what about the fact, and it's what Mr. Summers, the counsel for Denson, refers to as this, and he uses some very flowery language talking about a crazy, absurd, and goes so far, both in his brief and in his the closing of his argument today, it talks about this being an insane position that the state has taken with respect to the right of the state to prosecute, not only to prosecute, but to convict and punish for both of these offenses and to punish cumulatively for them. The argument is that, the argument on the other side is that it makes no sense to prohibit as the statute clearly does, a conviction for both conspiracy and the completed crime, but then permit, and therefore to limit the punishment for a person who does both to the punishment for the completed crime, but then allow, as adoption of our argument would do, allow the state to convict of both conspiracy and an attempt to commit the crime, which would then allow the state to not only impose a punishment equal to that of the completed crime, but also half again as much, tack on half again as much for the attempt. We would get the punishment for the completed crime by virtue of the fact that we've convicted him of conspiracy, which carries the same punishment as the completed crime, and then we would tack on an extra amount. I am willing to concede that that creates somewhat of an anomaly. I think it's the strongest argument my opponents have. But I think the Court of Appeals dealt with it correctly. I might concede it's an anomaly. I don't think it's absurd, and I don't think it's insane. It's clearly rational to want to convict and punish a person both for a conspiracy and for an attempt. And this would go back to the argument I was making in regard to Blackburger analysis and what have you. Each of the two crimes has their own evil, each with an additional element that constitutes a separate and distinct evil. The conspiracy, the combining, is a distinct evil from engaging in an activity that brings you right to the brink of actually committing the crime. So there's no question that it's appropriate to cumulatively punish for both. But the interaction of the statutes does create this anomaly. But I suggest to you that it's an anomaly that, as the Court of Appeals suggested, is one for the legislature to resolve.
What about the rule of lenity?
The rule of lenity only comes into play if the statute is ambiguous. And I have yet to see in my opponent's arguments, either in their briefs or here today, any argument that would create ambiguity in 939.72.2. Does not apply. It does not apply here because this was not the crime which is the objective of the conspiracy, this attempted murder.
But the fundamental purpose of statutory interpretation is to discern the intent of the legislature. And how do you answer the charge that this is an absurd result, that the legislature is going to allow more for the incomplete crime than for the completed crime?
Well, I think that, I'll answer that, but I'll also preface my answer by saying you can't create legislation, this court cannot create legislation out of whole cloth. If this statute is not ambiguous, I don't care what label you want to put on it. I'm not ready to put the label absurd on it, but whatever label you put on it, you cannot read into that statute something that is not there. But I will answer your question. It may not be a satisfactory answer, but I will answer your question. When the legislature created this statute, it was faced with a situation where it had said the punishment we're going to impose for conspiracy is going to be the same as the punishment we impose for the completed crime. And the legislature said, when the guy goes ahead and follows the conspiracy through to completion, we're not willing to double the punishment for that crime. Having created the full punishment for the completed crime as the punishment for the conspiracy, they said we're not ready to allow you to cumulatively place on top of that the full punishment for the completed crime. Now, that's a legislative judgment that they made. I suggested that might be an anomaly. I don't know why you let a guy who has conspired to commit a crime get away with going through and committing it, and you don't punish him any more severely when you have said that conspiracy itself is serious enough to warrant full punishment for a completed crime. I think there's an anomaly there. In any case, having created that, what I'm really referring to as an anomaly, but whether you are or not, does not probably make any difference. The fact is, that's what they have created. Now they move on and they say, okay, what about, insofar as they may have thought about this, I'm simply arguing why they could reasonably have done what they did here. Now they move on and they are confronted with the situation we've got in this case, where they have created a punishment for the conspiracy as the same as the punishment for the completed crime, but with respect to attempt, they have said it's half the punishment for a completed crime. And so now what they've been confronted with was not whether or not we are going...
You may finish.
Whether or not we are going to cumulatively punish to the full extent of the punishment for the completed crime, that we're going to impose that twice. We are confronted with the situation where they're going to impose the punishment for the completed crime for the conspiracy, but only half as much for the attempt. And then they have said in that situation, because we see distinct and cumulative evils involved in the conspiracy and the attempt, we're ready to subject the guy to 1.5 times. We weren't ready to go to twice when it was a conspiracy and a completed crime, but when it's conspiracy and the attempt, we're ready to go to 1.5. We can argue about whether or not that represents sound public policy or not. It certainly would be a reasonable approach here, and would be a reasonable explanation as to why you might do the one, or you might forbid the one, and not allow the double punishment, but permit, as could potentially happen in this case, the imposition of the cumulative punishment, which is only 1.5 times, not the doubling up that you had in the other situation. My red light is on, and I thank the court.
You know what I see as your weakness? I see that the concept that objective of the conspiracy has to be murder and not attempted murder. It's too narrow a reading. That, if you read the statute that way, for every failed conspiracy that has failed in its ultimate objective and you have an attempt, it falls into it gets under two. Just blows that all open. Right? Anytime you have a conspiracy,
yes,
for an ultimate crime, conspiracy is a completed crime.
Yes.
The ultimate crime is not completed. Bank robbery. So if you have a conspiracy and a bank robbery, and then you have attempted bank robbery, you can do the same thing you're doing in this case. I may have picked a bad example because I don't know the rest of the statutes, but that's in essence what you're asking the court to hold.
If I understand the question correctly, yes. Now, but you said there was a weakness in my argument?
I think that you're reading objective of the conspiracy to mean exactly the same thing on part of the crime, rather than reading it broadly to mean that the objective of the conspiracy was homicide. The objective of the attempted murder was also homicide. It didn't succeed, but that was the objective of that crime.
What? Attempted murder? Well...
Sure. Wasn't that what they were looking for?
I'm sorry?
Isn't that what they were trying... Isn't that what they were charged with? Attempted homicide?
They were charged with conspiracy to commit completed homicide.
Right.
So, and that was the objective of the conspiracy. That language can't be read any other way?
We made part company.
Could I ask one other question?
Yes.
In terms of legislative history, 93972, according to the statutes I have, became law in the 1991 session of the legislature. Are you familiar with any other, was there any statute preceding that was substantively the same?
You say that not, you're referring to
93972.
72, rather, 72-2, and you're saying that you think that it came into being with what legislature?
1991 legislature.
Well, this is a provision that traces itself back to the 1953-55 revision of the Criminal Code, and there is obviously comments to that and also the Platt's Law Review article, but I don't think I don't find anything in there that either supports my opponent's position or
undermines mine. The
doesn't talk about attempt and conspiracy?
No, no.
Okay.
Doesn't speak to that at all.
I guess my question is, if there's anything in Nutley that hurts you, is it changed at all by the passage of
93972? Well, Nutley would have been after 93972.
So Nutley in 1964?
Whoops, yeah, right. And this was, as I said, part of the 1953-55 revision of the criminal code. So that would have, these statutes would have been fully in place by the time of Nutley. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Becker. Mr. Summers.
Okay, there are a few points that have been made by the opposing counsel which I'd like to address. The first point I'd like to address is concern expressed by my fellow counsel. When I use the phrase insane, I'm not at all suggesting this court is insane. All I'm saying is that I believe to allow such a result, that would be an insane result. And it's, that's...
Thank you, counsel. We're
inspired. And in regards to that insane result, a couple points. First of all is, in this case, and I've asked this court to read the criminal complaint, which is in the appendix of my reply brief, and if you read the preliminary hearing transcript, what is being put forth by the state, which they would be proving to show that my client was, let's say, party to the crime, either by aiding or abetting or by conspiracy, would be that he was sitting in a room when the conspiracy was hatched, to which he was silent, and then that he did one act. He allegedly drove the gunman from a house to a gas station. That's it. It would be the identical conduct in this case where they would get both of the convictions. And I think on that alone there should be double jeopardy concerns. I do not agree with Blackburger. I think I have my problems with that case. But I think even with that being, let's say, the law of the land, this is still double jeopardy due to the second prong of that test. They are asking this court to read the statute in isolation. They're asking this court to read it in a literal fashion that ignores the other statutes, and it ignores, as I put forth before, logic, elementary logic, A, B, and C. Further, the legislative history shows that when this law was, or when this bill was put forth, Legislative Bill Number 100, which is in the appendix of my fellow counsel's brief, paragraph 5, subparagraph F says that for the purpose of this is to strengthen certain procedural safeguards such as the rule against double jeopardy. They wanted to protect defendants against double jeopardy. And I would put forth, their reasoning is shown by the very statute where they say, by the very statute where they say you can't be convicted of conspiracy and for the completed crime, as I pointed out. Prior to the crime is part of conspiracy. And further, I would say the legislative intent is clearly shown by the fact that they passed 939-32, subparagraph 1, subparagraph A, where they say if it's only an attempt, it should be half the potential punishment. How could the state legislature make it more clear that it is their intent that successful criminals face more potential punishment than unsuccessful criminals? It's just so simple. And really, that's what they're the ones that are trying to muddy the waters. They're trying to take this very literal reading where you ignore everything else, all the other statutes, and even ignore common sense to say, you can do this, even though it will achieve a result in which they say, well, they won't go so far to say it's insane or absurd and so on and so on, but even they acknowledge that there are problems with that. And I would just simply put forth that this court cannot do that. And it would really turn the law on its head, turn the entire law on its head, and think of the practical consequences. All it takes is one case for it to get out to the public. One guy to realize he's about to complete a sexual assault. He's about to complete an armed robbery. If he goes forward with the crime, he's facing less time. You can't allow that to happen. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes our hearing on 1999-1768 and 1769. Moffitt v. Benson. Court is in recess until Monday at 9:45.